Hello, this is Dee Roberts Keenan with Smart TV. Today we're going to be talking to you about the sin of greed, which also goes by the name avarice, and we're going to be exploring an episode of Sliders I like very much. It's called Luck of the Draw. It was from the Sliders first season, I believe. I believe it was the season finale for their season one. If you've got the DVDs, it can be found on disc 3. It's episode 2 there. In this episode, basically, the Sliders, if you are aware at all with the premise, they slide to a world where everything seems perfect, and then they realize that the reason it is perfect is that there's this lottery that is, in reality, population control. And we go through this sort of idyllic phase here where they're discovering how wonderful everything is. The prices are all cheap. The people are very friendly, they're very giving and very generous and all this, that, and the other thing. And the Sliders, our gang of four here, they really get sort of addicted to this sort of, you know, good, peaceful little life. There's, for longtime fans of the show, this episode is a little odd in the sense that it starts off with sort of a plot device that nobody, you know, really, I mean, that hasn't been used before. We've got Wade sort of keeping this journal, which is really never referred to again. We've also got both Rembrandt and Wade sort of having different love interests. And, you know, usually while you might see, for example, Quinn, you know, getting people sort of attracted to him, yada yada, this is the first episode really where we've got these people practically falling in love at, you know, first sight. It's a little odd. As with any Sliders episode, there are all sorts of, like, cute little in-jokes and, you know, pop culture references. We just saw the billboard for BC Cola, which is birth control in a can. Here we've got the lottery, which, strangely enough, that sort of ATM design, it looks an awful lot like an old lottery logo that they used to use here in the state of Washington. So I just find that kind of amusing. I also have to laugh at how comically false this ATM ends up looking when these guys take money from it. But, you know, anyway. Greed is really what we're talking about, and here we see a lot of sort of idle greed. Right now, they're taking out this money. Remy, he wants $5,000. He doesn't realize that this basically means he's got 5,000 chances to die in this lottery. We're gonna, you know, Arturo is much more, you know, he's just, let's get the bare minimum here. And so he takes that $5. And I love how his $5 bill, it comes out and it's just like, it looks all wrinkly. It looks so tiny. You know, I mean, it's just like, it cracks me up. Which is, given how pompous Arturo becomes in later episodes, I'm really surprised that he didn't take more here. But we've got to have some sort of reason to put both Wade and Remy into danger. Sliders is nothing if not sort of like a complex morality tale. And each episode sort of in its own little way has this sort of morality play aspect to it. And what we're seeing here is basically, anyway, I just had to let that line go through, you know. What we're seeing here is basically Wade and Remy being so greedy and sort of lusting after this life so much that they get sucked into it, and it really puts them in danger of losing their lives, which is, truth be told, how a lot of Sliders episodes work, where we've got one of the characters who really wants something or goes after something really big in the wrong way, and then it ends up turning out really horribly for all of them. But luckily, because of the way that this show is structured, they can just slide out, you know, at the end of the episode, and, you know, no harm, no foul. This is a rare episode in that at the end of the episode, I'll talk about this a little bit more at the end of the episode, but this is one of the episodes where it really is important to watch them in the sequence they were intended. Fox did a really screwed up thing, and he, or not, not he, Fox, the Fox Network, they aired the shows way out of sequence. I mean, and it's ridiculous because the Tracy Torme and the other people who were doing the whole Sliders thing, they were trying to create some sort of a story, some sort of an arc, because otherwise this is just episodic television. It's, you know, it's not, there's nothing to keep it going from week to week, and they really wanted to create sort of like a serial effect, and that was really screwed up in right off the bat when, after airing the pilot, Fox, I think they aired like episode 3, and then they aired episode 4, and then they got around to airing episode 2, and then they followed that up with like episode 5. I mean, it was just, I mean, it was ridiculous. And I probably got the sequence wrong here, but there, Google Sliders episode list and blah, 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 and you'll come up with a dozen sites that really complain about this a whole lot. The thing about this particular episode, though, and why I chose this episode, is this episode really deals a lot with sort of consequences. This episode really is all about the consequences of your actions, and it raises a sort of interesting moral / ethical / theological question, which is it a sin if you don't know it's a sin? The premise of the episode, that they're in this world, this peaceful world, that's got this lottery where, you know, you can get anything you want. You know, it's like, what's the price? And when Wade and Rembrandt go so far beyond what is, you know, normal, you know, I mean, here we've, for the first time and perhaps the only time, we've got Arturo being held up as the normal, you know, the normal for this world. We wonder, what are the, you know, why should Wade and Remy be held accountable? Well, they need to be held accountable, as any sort of, you know, Middle Ages theologian would tell you, because, you know, ignorance of the law is no excuse, to coin a cliche there. It didn't matter in the Middle Ages if you didn't know what you were doing was a sin, because you were expected to know. Exactly. I mean, you are expected to have this sort of complete knowledge of what the right thing to do at any given time was. And of course, the great irony in that is that we have sort of, you know, these, we have kings and we have priests and bishops and popes even back during this time who were completely corrupt and, you know, riddled with sin and it's almost incomprehensible today. If you think about what we think of as, you know, corruption scandals, where we've got, paying off a couple of congressmen, or, you know, using our lobbying advantages, or, you know, what the scandals of today, with the sort of scandals that were just completely routine and covered up in the Middle Ages, where we had, you know, people being, you know, assassinated, and we had, you know, huge illegal land grabs and all sorts of nepotism going on in the Pope's office and this, that, and the other thing. If that sort of thing were to go on today, we'd be horrified. We'd be shocked. It would be the stuff of a bad suspense novel. But back then, at that time, that was all very sort of normal, and no one, you know, really questioned it. It was only sort of the poor, the disenfranchised, who are expected to lead these sort of perfect, blameless lives. And a lot of that really has to do with the sorts of scriptures that were expounded upon back then. It was a very sort of, you know, the meek shall inherit the earth type deal, where they were expected to stay in their place and not revolt and, you know, not want anything else, because their reward was going to come later in heaven. And so, in a sense, we get this genesis for making the seven deadly sins such a big part of sort of the medieval pop culture, where you were expected to avoid these things, you were expected to stay on the right path, because your reward was coming up later. But the people that were telling them this, you know, the kings and the clergy, were completely flouting this particular law. I mean, there was hardly any sort of European royalty, or you know, I mean, I can't speak outside of European history because I'm not extremely well versed in that, but there was, you know, during this, you know, roughly 500-600 year period, there was really, I mean, there was really not a lot of, you know, decent, you know, what we would think of as good rulers. Back then, the good rulers were the ones that conquered the neighbors and, you know, sort of led their own country to prosperity for a couple of decades. Right here, we're talking about Thomas Malthus, and Arturo, of course, is responsible for a lot of the sort of weird exposition of this show. He's a professor, and even though he's a physics professor, he's somehow this brilliant expert on, I mean, you know, brilliant expert on philosophy and economic theory and history and anything else. I mean, he's the resident know-it-all. What I do find interesting, though, is that, you know, Wade mentions later that she studies, I think it was literature, and anyone who studied, like, English literature would have discussed Thomas Malthus, would have talked about his influence on sort of literature of the day. And also would have talked about, you know, Jonathan Swift. I mean, his famous Modest Proposal. And if you aren't familiar with that, I do suggest you Google Jonathan Swift and Modest Proposal. It's, I mean, there are books, there are theses that are dedicated completely to this. One of the interesting things about the structure of the lottery is how much it perpetuates the sort of greed cycle. How much they talk about, you know, you get everything you want and you don't have to pay for it, and you can have more and more and more, and you get this special white card, and everything that you want, you get. And they don't tell you, they don't really tell you what the cost is. And, you know, later, as we see, Arturo will be completely baffled, and Quinn is the one who uncovers the real story. Headbands are not an attractive look for Sabrina Lloyd. I just have to say that. Yeah, she ends up, Wade always in this show has to look like such a tomboy, such a just sort of like, you know, one of the guys. And this is one of the rare episodes where we really get to see how attractive and how beautiful Sabrina Lloyd really is. She was always cute as Wade, and this is one of the few episodes that we get to see her as being really glamorous and really, really interesting to look at. I have this complaint about the other two shows that, you know, she's been associated with. Sports Night, which we talked about last time, and, you know, Numbers. She was, for some reason, I don't know what happened, she was on the first season of Numbers, and then when she left, I just lost complete and total interest in that show, so sue me. But, you know, they did the same thing on Sports Night, where they would always put her in this sort of tomboy role. And I think, as you see later, when she gets, you know, she cleans up real good. I mean, she really is a strikingly beautiful woman. And, I mean, to keep her in this sort of, you know, tomboy role, it just doesn't make any sense to me. I'd love to see, like, a romantic comedy where she gets to be really girly, because I think she pulls it off really well. And, you know, that's just me. But, yeah. Okay, so here we're arriving, you know, at these boutiques, and we're going shopping, and we get this whole fun sort of montage of, like, San Francisco, the uncrowded version. And it cracks me up that they say earlier that there are only 500,000 people, or, no, I'm sorry, there are fewer than 100,000 people who live in San Francisco, and it's like they're all here on the streets right now, because it just doesn't make any sense. I mean, if this is like this sort of small town, San Francisco is a huge, huge city. And we've got basically just, everyone's in this one downtown corridor. So it really amuses me when, especially on this show, you've got the plot that doesn't match up with what we're seeing on the screen. But this was sort of, you know, how they just did it back then. It was a show from this new network, and it was a sci-fi show, and nobody really wanted to devote any time or energy to it. You know, thank God that we don't get what happened in the later seasons, where they were even less original about this sort of thing, and where pretty much every episode was exactly the same in terms of set design, you know, and it was all interchangeable because they were all fighting the Cro-Mags and yada yada. I don't want to get in there. Okay. I've been watching this show for a very, very long time. And it was so, I have to share this little anecdote. I got this DVD set, which retails for like $50. I got it for like $11 at this newsroom auction. I work for a newspaper doing my day job. And the last newspaper that I worked for, what would happen is that studios and production companies and, you know, basically just, you know, marketing people would send the newspaper all sorts of stuff. You know, the spice companies would send bottles of spices, and the TV studios would send, you know, pilots and DVDs, and the movie companies would send press kits and t-shirts and blah 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 and blah blah blah. Well, you know, even for as large as the paper that I was working for was, there wasn't a lot of call for a lot of this stuff. So this stuff would just get stockpiled. And what would happen is every so often, one of the people in the newsroom would set everything up on a table, and we'd have a big silent auction of all this stuff. And all the money would be then donated to charity, basically. And so I remember walking in, and there was like the Knight Rider DVD set, and there was like the Apprentice DVD set, and there was like, you know, the Sliders DVD set, and all this stuff we were seeing like a month before it was actually going to come out in stores. They were all like, you know, review copies. And so I got in this really fierce bidding war with this other guy for Knight Rider, and I just barely lost that one. I mean, I was still irritated because I really love that show. It's so awful. I have this thing for really bad television, and, you know, like, not VIP bad, but maybe like a step above. And I think Knight Rider was like a step above that. You know, I'm not one to watch like Highlander, but anyway, that's just me. So then I sort of lucked out because somebody had outbid me for Sliders, but then withdrew his bid at the last moment. And, you know, so when the auction ends, you know, I'm left with the first two seasons of this show, which had been one of my favorites growing up. And so, I mean, anyway, that's kind of a pointless anecdote, but at least it shows you how I got the set for so cheap. As I said before, Wade really does look incredible. Sabrina Lloyd is a beautiful, beautiful woman. And I love that this dress lets her be sort of beautiful and glamorous. And it's almost a letdown. It's almost a letdown at the end. Oh. He left his money to the Sierra Club. This is Ryan. And if I remember correctly, Ryan, we only get to see in, like, this one episode, even though he slides with them at the end. And then there's like some weird throwaway line of dialogue at the beginning of the next episode, Into the Mystic, which wasn't supposed to be the next episode. It's all crazy. Like I said, Google Sliders and episode list, and you'll hear all about that. Here we've got sort of Remy's sub story. I mean, he's got the B plot this week, but it's the one that really is sort of a lot more perilous, because he falls in love so fast, and he wants to save this woman, and this is so completely out of character for Rembrandt, but Clavant Derrix really makes it work. I really like Clavant Derrix. He also starred in the original Broadway show Dreamgirls, which is probably one of my very, very favorite musical theater scores. And those of you who don't listen to musicals and don't like musicals, seriously, when they're making a movie, Eddie Murphy is going to be playing the role that Clavant Derrix originated and won a Tony for. This is a phenomenal, phenomenal score. And even those of you who claim that you don't like musical theater will like this. It's like a Motown opera. It's brilliant. The music is so incredibly wonderful. Anyway, that's my plug for Dreamgirls. So anyway, back to Remy and the B-plot, and we're seeing how sort of his greed, how, you know, his greed is sort of taking over him, and he's not greedy just for the cash, even though he did take the most out, but as we see, because he was so greedy earlier, he's really going to have to sort of have the biggest consequence later on. I'm assuming that you've seen this episode, or that you're at least somewhat vaguely familiar with this, so that nothing I'm saying here is really going to come as too much of a big surprise. You know that, I mean, for example, you know that they're going to get out of this life or death situation that they've placed themselves into, because the show ran for another few years. What what is interesting to me here is how we see Rembrandt sort of do this weird change where he stops becoming this sort of self-absorbed person, and now all of a sudden he's becoming sort of altruistic, and he's becoming sort of this guy who wants to save the girl. What he doesn't realize is that the girl doesn't want to be saved, and the girl is horrified and offended at he would try to save her. And that really places him in sort of an interesting moral sort of dilemma, I think. You know, I mean, what does he do? He can go on without her, and then he's lost this great love that he met, you know, 47 minutes ago. Or, you know, he can sort of, I mean, you know, live with the knowledge, you know, take, you know, I mean, he can save her, but she doesn't want to be saved. You know, she's full well aware at what's going on. She knows exactly what happens, and she's happy that she can leave her family some extra cash. Yeah. Ryan is in the grand tradition of sort of, you know, beaux of the week who swoop in and say the sexy thing and get to swoop right back out. And this happens on every single show in the world. I mean, there's always a boyfriend of the week. There's always a girlfriend of the week. There's always blah, blah, blah. But Ryan is really such a cipher. He's a nice guy, and we know that because he left his lottery money to the Sierra Club. And we know that, I mean, you know, that he's this great adventure guy, and he's really cool, and he's just what Wade is looking for. And he wants to, I mean, you know, he likes Wade and blah, blah, blah. So we know, of course, that, I mean, he's doomed, really. In fact, you know, the fact that they end up sliding out with him just strikes me as completely improbable, because in this grand, time-worn, cliched structure, he's supposed to valiantly stay behind and die so they can escape and go to freedom, and then, I mean, you know, then he's this great blah, blah, blah. So, anyway, yeah. Yeah. Arturo's starting to get suspicious here. He's starting to realize that perhaps their actions have much direr consequences than they originally thought. Yeah. I really like watching Sabrina Lloyd smile. She smiles, she laughs almost better than anyone else in the business. She's so underrated as an actress. I mean, she really, really is. Okay, so here Quinn with the backstory. He's got the big reveal. You know, they're going to kill Wade. And then, of course, we see her dancing with her doomed lover. And it's all so tragic and mythic and just, oh, cut to commercial. Okay, we're back from commercial. And, yeah, we see Remy starting to be this sort of altruistic person, where he started out being the greediest among the lot. Now he wants to do the right thing. Now he wants to turn it all around. He wants to redeem himself. What he doesn't realize, I think, is that this sort of, I mean, this is almost literally a deathbed redemption, because we've got, you know, his lover about to enter her deathbed, and she wants to take him with her. I don't know. I think what we've got here is sort of a reminder that while it's never too late to change, that sometimes, you know, it's hard to do the right thing. And this, of course, like I said, Sliders really is a series of, you know, small morality plays. This really does come across here as wanting to show the difficulties involved with changing. I thought it was so interesting when I first started watching the show, and keep in mind I'm in my teens. But up until then, I had only seen shows where the characters change week after week, and that, you know, here we've got a situation set up where it's the situation that changes week after week. And for most of the first two seasons, the characters that we saw were pretty much, they were just personalities. They weren't really fully fleshed out in terms of what we would see in season three, which I think is probably just brilliant television all around. Where we've got, basically, if you watch television a lot, you'll notice that most of the time, you see these character arcs, and you see these characters who start out as one thing, and then their character is somehow subverted or changed throughout the course of a season or an entire series run, where you see that they're not really the same people that they were when the show started. For a very good example of this, I'll talk about Smallville for a minute, which I've discussed in these podcasts here. And Smallville, which starts out with Clark Kent being such a shy nebbish, being such a, you know, sort of withdrawn, sort of, you know, asocial person, where he's got just his couple of friends. And then we see that by now, by season five, he's like Mr. Popularity. He's, you know, he's sort of, you know, this great hero. Everyone turns to him for everything. It's really, it's the Clark of season five is not the Clark of season one. And, you know, there have been a number of things that have happened to change Clark from what he was then into what he is now. But the thing about it is that in Smallville, really, you had the same setting week after week. You had the exact same setup. And what you saw was the character changing, not the scenario. Here with Sliders, it's different. And you've got the same people, the same personalities being put into these vastly different situations. And when I was a teenager and when I'd seen this the first time, I was really blown away by that. I thought that was really, really interesting and profound, that, you know, that you could comment on who these people were by just by changing where they were. And, you know, now when I look at that, I see it is a little bit clumsy. And here we see, especially in this episode, we see the writers trying to break and trying to show the characters changing. And you saw earlier with Wade and Quinn, you saw that they were, you know, trying to talk about this sort of, you know, this love story arc that keeps getting picked up and dropped and picked up and dropped. But this is a rare episode for the first about season and a half where this arc is really more about the characters changing than it is about the world that they've changed into. So there's my little, you know, my little TV critique for the moment. We're still talking about greed, really, even though I've gone off on many tangents during the course of this little podcast. And there are basically two types of greed. There is sort of the idle greed and the active avarice. And what we saw mostly in this episode was sort of the idle greed, sort of the wishing, sort of the I want money. The active avarice is a little more direct. I mean, for one, it's a lot more active. It's when you're actively going out and trying to accumulate as much as you can. And we saw that to some small extent when Wade goes on her shopping trip and, you know, she gets to flash her white card. And that was much more of the active avarice. That's sort of the, you know, that's like the big version of greed. And then, you know, earlier was just sort of the idle greed, like, well, hey, I want money and I can have money. And, you know, I'm gonna take more money than I need because I just like to have that money. And we see, too, with Wade that she gets to become a little bit more altruistic than earlier before, whereas she started at the beginning of the episode, you know, a little greedy. Now she's a little bit more concerned with other people. Yet, still, it's not complete altruism because she's concerned about saving her own skin. You know, she really is sort of selfish in that regard. And selfishness is very, very closely related to greed. And it's, I think some people use the terms practically interchangeably. We think of selfish a lot as, you know, we have this image in our head, say, of, you know, a kindergarten tot, you know, hanging on to the toy truck that he isn't playing with, but he's got to have it. And we look at that and we say, hey, don't be so greedy. When what we really mean is, hey, don't be so selfish. And we link them in our heads, I think, because it's this idea of wanting something that we don't really need. And some small part of us is sort of has that pounded into us. I think for very much the same reason why in the Middle Ages, why they would preach things like, you know, the meek shall inherit the earth, because they wanted to instill this idea that we shouldn't be too ambitious, that we shouldn't be wanting stuff we don't need, that we shouldn't be wanting more than what we have, more than what God has given to us. It's a confusing situation to be in. And it's one that many theologians and many writers and many philosophers have really struggled with over the time, over the centuries, over the millennia, really. You know, how much is enough? How much is too much? You know, how much can you want something before it starts controlling your life? And as we see here, in a very real sense, greed is controlling their lives. Those who are not greedy, those who do not lust for anything beyond their means, they are allowed to live in this paradise world. They are allowed to sort of, you know, live in this world where the streets are safe and not crowded at all, and everyone's happy and carrots are cheap. And if you want more than that, if you want more than what everyone else has, you know, then you play this lottery. And there comes the real risk that with this lottery game, that you are going to find yourself dead. That's kind of disturbing and horrific if you think about it, but of course the way the episode is placed, we don't really have to think about that sort of aspect too much. But it's all about what is the episode telling us. This here is such an idealized vision of sort of death and passing on and all this, that, and the other thing. It's, you know, we're told that it's painless, and we're told that it's, you know, that it's this beautiful thing that people really dream about. They focus a lot on the afterlife here. And, you know, to me, I feel that really has strong parallels with the medieval ideal here, where I mean, really, you've got these people who are sitting around and, you know, they focus so much on getting to the afterlife and leading these beautiful, idealized lives, but it's all about the reward in the next world. And that is something that is very sort of, you know, Middle Ages here. I have to laugh because she's talking about being joined, you know, through for all eternity. And I've been watching Big Love, and I have Mormon friends, and it just, the whole thing is just very, very amusing to me. that's a very Mormon thing to say about being joined together for all eternity. So anyway, these lines of dialogue are hilarious if you listen to them. She's talking, she's like, "This is so delicious. It's like, it's ambrosia." And I really laugh at that, because ambrosia was the food of the gods. And here it's just, I don't know if it's intentional or if it's just sort of bad, hacky sci-fi writing, but the idea that eating the food of the gods will lead to your death is certainly, some part of me thinks that it had to be deliberate to do it like that. It feels like it was done sort of clumsily. But of course, eating at the table of the gods is in and of itself greedy. I mean, we should not, you know, if you listen to the medieval theologians, we should not want to be eating from a better table. We should be content with what we have in life. And it really cracks me up that the laws of this world are so twisted that these people who volunteer to die are, you know, they're killed very painlessly and it's very peaceful. This guy who really wants to stay alive is being told that he has to go to the municipal processing center where he's going to be killed very, very painfully. And I'm like, what kind of world is that? You know, I mean, where it's like torture is okay if you want to live, but if you want to die, it's sort of, you know, very, I don't know. Ugh, whatever. Oh, Lordy. Poor Arturo. I mean, he's so brilliant, you know, but sometimes he is so slow to come around. So, yeah. It's like, we need to walk the dog now. I mean, like, duh. I mean, hello. Anyway. I think that's a really interesting line that Wade says, where she says, you know, the worst crime here is tampering with the lottery. And I'm like, worse than... It's like, here, in our world, let's say murder is probably the worst crime that one can commit. And on this world, trying to prevent killing, you know, is the worst crime that you can commit. You know, in our world, the most heinous thing you could do would be to, you know, to torture someone until they died. And on this world, the act of trying to save someone from being killed will get you tortured. I mean, it's just, it's so, it boggles the mind. It's so twisty, turvy, topsy, downy, uppy, weirdo, inside outy. Yeah. So, of course, now we have the real crisis. We've had a series of minor crises, but now here's the... It seems like in every episode, there's always one thing where it seems like they might not slide. And here, if the guys don't, you know, if the guys don't make it in time, Wade has to slide alone. So we'll see, you know, we'll see how that turns out. Wonder what'll happen there. I don't know. This is hilarious. This is probably my favorite part of this episode where, I mean, it's just funny. You've got this, like, video, like, hey, you're gonna die now, so, you know, here's what you need to know. And, you know, Rembrandt talking back to the video, but the stuff that he's saying is just really, it's highly comical. If you didn't watch the episode before you listened to this, or you weren't planning on watching it after listening to this, go back and watch this scene, because it's just, I mean, it's funny. Yeah. Nobody does, like, righteous indignation like Clavon Derricks. So, it is what it is. What I also find is really interesting is how obvious it is that this is all being done on, like, a set, because we can't see anything except for, like, a light. Also, these signs are really, really interesting, because, of course, this is drawing a parallel between, you know, sort of the right to life or movement here, you know, and sort of, I think, sort of the pro-life movement that we've got here, you know, in our Earth, where, I mean, these are like rabid, crazy, freaky people. And I really wonder what the politics of the show's writers were. It's like, what are they trying to say by, you know, by presenting this sort of right to lifer movement? You know, what are they, you know, are they trying to deliberately comment on how, you know, sort of the death penalty and abortion are wrong in our world? Are they just sort of trying to present just sort of an interesting, dramatic viewpoint? Is it, you know, A lot of the politics seem really inconsistent when you watch the show, you, from episode to episode, and you see different things being presented in different ways. And I prefer to think it's because the writers and the showrunners were more interested in telling sort of captivating, compelling stories rather than pushing a particular political viewpoint. And I say that only up until the time when the Cro-Mags become sort of a recurring character. And after that, there's this weird sort of anti-fascist... not that I think fascism is good, but there really is sort of an anti-fascist, anti-sort of leftist sort of viewpoint that the show suddenly became, you know, focused on for a long, long time. And I don't know if they thought that that would just be sort of interesting sci-fi, because I didn't think it was very good sci-fi, or if it was really sort of like, you know, thinly veiled politicism, which, you know, I think as the original people involved with the shows sort of stopped being involved with it. I think it sort of evolved into something else. Not that I wasn't still watching, but I had a lot more of those questions about, you know, why are we being shown this? And, you know, what can we really be saying here? Okay, I have no idea why that car just crashed there. I am completely flummoxed. I don't know why they thought it would be a good idea to just crash into that car. If they were trying to create a diversion, I think it was just because they thought, we need a car crash here, and so we're going to run into a parked car at top speed. And now, oh, unfortunately, Wade has changed back into being sort of the little tomboy. And the dog. What is up with the dog? I think, oh man, I haven't watched these in so long, really. I mean, I can't really remember what happens. I think Ryan ends up with the dog, and we get a line of dialogue to that effect in a couple episodes. After they air all weird and out of order. Who knows? Now, their detective work is just astonishing. I mean, I don't know. It's crazy here. Yeah. The show is, I think, always more interesting when you put a character like Wade, sort of a lovable... Wade really is the everyman, not so much Rembrandt, because Rembrandt originally was supposed to be the everyman character here, but Wade really is the everyman. She's the one who is, you know, sort of, I think, represents the viewpoint of the audience the most. And, you know, here we've got, you know, because we never get to see Wade do her computer thing. It's like every few episodes they pull up, oh, Wade's a huge computer genius and she can hack anything. But in most of the episodes, really, Wade represents the viewpoint of the audience way more so than Rembrandt. Because Rembrandt is sort of, I mean, he's not like a science-y person, but he's like this... He's like a comic relief, really, not so much the everyman. All the Rembrandt centered episodes were they were so show busy, and they were so sort of, you know, big and bold and, you know, painted with these huge strokes. Anyway, back to Wade being the everyman. It's always more interesting when Wade can be in danger. And the show was never as interesting after she left the show. You know, in large part because of that. Because there wasn't that character that the audience could really identify with. They tried to bring it back in the fifth season where they had this other Quinn Mallory. And it was weird and it was wrong. And it felt really forced. But it is what it is. Here again was what I was saying about consequences, and because of the greed of Wade and Rembrandt, although they were able to save Ryan and Henry, Quinn got shot. I mean, and this is, you know, this will play a role in some of the next couple of episodes. Oh my God, it's Quinn! Oh no, I remember. This is the morality play, that greed leads to, you know, leads to the downfall, not for yourself, you know, but for the people you care about. And this is an episode that really talks about, I love Sabrina Lloyd as a screamer. This is an episode that really talks about how, you know, how greed is bad, how it is wrong to want that sort of thing so frequently. So, anyway, I hope you've enjoyed listening to this latest podcast in the Seven Deadly Podcast series. Again, this is D. Roberts Keenan, and I thank you very much for listening.